Good afternoon. Thank goodness the bells have stopped for a few minutes anyway, hopefully. I'm Nola Radcock from the Parliamentary Library, and I'd like to welcome today Dr. Nicola Spruan, who's been chair of the Government 2.0 Task Force. Dr. Spruan has worked in a diverse range of public policy and other roles since 1981. And as an economic policy advisor within the government, as associate commissioner in the Productivity Commission, director of the Business Council of Australia's New Directions Economic Reform Project, and CEO of Lateral Economics. Dr. Spruan holds a PhD and Bachelor of Arts Honours First Class from the ANU and a Doctor of Laws from Melbourne University. He's published in national and international academic journals on a range of issues, including tariff reform, competition policy, intellectual property, innovation in government, and macroeconomic policy. He's been a regular contributor for a number of newspapers and other blogs and literature, and been a consultant to the Department of Finance and the Regulation on Continuous Improvement and Regulation. He's also a chairman of the National Forum, which hosts a popular online opinion website, and a board member of Sustainability Victoria. But certainly today, Dr. Spruan is here to expand on the work that he has been sharing with the Government 2.0 Task Force. I think we hear so much about the technology, about what Web 2.0 means, about all the implications of social networking, but I think Dr. Spruan today wants to take us beyond the technology to what is a very important issue about engaging with government. So I'd like you to welcome him today. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm pleased that I had that drum roll of 4 minutes of bells before I began. I remember I was working in John Button's office in 1981. No, it wasn't. It was 1983. And we were buying $7 billion worth of Sikorsky helicopters, and the executives couldn't really believe what was happening because they kept meeting with this this big wig in the government, if you'll allow me to use that word somewhat liberally in the case of John Button. He kept saying, sorry, I've got to go, and the bells would ring, and like Pavlov's dog, he'd race off again for another 10 minutes. Anyway, so that's the way we do things here. So I'm going to talk to you about Government 2.0. It's the talk I'm going to give you is a general talk to sort of familiarise you with some of the ideas, and then we kind of taper down towards the end to some of the recommendations that we made, and even then, just the major ones. Because the really interesting stuff is this extraordinary new phenomenon and the incredible possibilities that are now before us. There's a little general knowledge test. My guess is you don't know who these people are. You probably know who he is. It's Adam Smith. That's Friedrich Hayek. You know who these people are. And I'm going to miraculously draw these threads together at the end of the presentation. So there you are, that's something to look forward to or not, as the case may be. So that's an outline of what I'm going to talk about. And I guess what I'm trying to do is to, you know, it's very easy. You'll read in Web 2, Gov 2 literature, you read a lot of, I don't know, kind of hippie stuff, you know, sort of how everything's going to happen and it's all inevitable and we're all sort of letting our hair hang out. And I guess what I sort of believe some of that stuff, but in order to make it powerful, you actually have to present compelling examples. And you also have to realise that if you're going to loosen up certain controls, it's really fairly easy to screw things up. And in governments, we have to keep that in mind as well. So, firstly, what is Web 2? Quick show of hands for those who've got a pretty good feel of what we mean by Web 2.0. Yeah, not everyone by any means, so it's sort of fun to go through this. My definition of Web 2.0 is kind of defined by You know, Web 1.0 defines itself by implication against Web 2.0. The analogy is with this idea that, you know, you get Microsoft Word 1.0 and then the next version of the software is 2.0, and it, as opposed to Microsoft Word 1.2, which would be some incremental improvement, Microsoft Word 2.0 is a kind of complete repackaging of the program. And that's kind of the idea. So Tim O'Reilly, first a consultant in America, first popularised this term. Somebody cooked it up in 1999. I discovered a day after saying that Tim O'Reilly cooked it up. That's how this world happens. You get corrected very quickly if you're wrong. And in fact, I checked it on Wikipedia 3 days before making the claim, and then it had been corrected on Wikipedia when I went back. And I thought, oh, well, no, you know, this is wrong. And I went back on Wikipedia and it spoke back to me. Some woman had cooked up this term in 1999. Anyway, its currency, its sort of thrill value begins in 2004. And the difference between Web 1 and Web 2 is that Web 1, there's nothing very exciting about email in a kind of conceptual sense. It's turbocharged letters. I remember watching my brother and my father write letters to each other across the country on email in the early 80s and thinking, God, this is so powerful. All we need now is to be able to attach files to this and extraordinary things could happen. And it took an amazingly long period of time for that to happen. It took another decade or more. And broadcast, these are, you know, websites are sort of like corporate brochures. There is one big qualitative difference, and that is that you can answer back. This is a sort of hub and spoke model, and you can not only read what Qantas or ANZ Banking have to offer you, you can actually partake of some of those services online, but always in relationship back to the company. And then, bang, Web 2 does what really had been, you can take this back to the beginning of the web with open source software. I regard open source software as a sort of Web 2 application, but the dates are all wrong because that got going in 1991. But anyway, this is this explosion of ad hoc, chaotic cooperation and collaboration. How does that happen on Google? Well, it's all concealed from you. But the simplest, apart from the fact that they harvest the collaborative knowledge of the web itself by working out who links to whom and therefore which is a more important website, they're watching you the whole time. And if they keep serving, if you put in banks and the firm that answers their algorithm is the Arab bank, and that goes up the top, and Westpac comes, you know, Westpac or Commonwealth comes in two or three, they're going to figure out within 100 hits that Arab Bank isn't the one that people typically click through to, and they're going to rearrange. So in a sense, the people who are using the site are collaborating with each other, even though they don't know it. These other forms of collaboration are entirely clear and transparent, and we'll just get back to that list a little later. But it's also quite striking how late in the piece, you know, Twitter exists, it just came into existence in 2006 as a sort of kind of a crazy idea. But also it would be obvious, I think, that there ought to be some sort of multilateral equivalent of SMSing. That was kind of what they were banking on. And then the thing, you know, lots of people are not all that familiar with how Twitter works. They know of Twitter, but it really is an extraordinary medium in a quite narrow, and is extraordinarily good at a kind of quite narrow number of things. And a lot of what it did actually got cooked up by the users. The people who invented Twitter provided the platform, and then the users cooked up these ideas like hashtags. Twitter didn't think of hashtags, and I'll take it for those who don't know what a hashtag is or do know what a hashtag is but don't know what it signifies or what's cool about it. I'll delay that till questions. Okay, so what is Web 2.0? It's not fancy technology, and in fact Clay Shirky in the book, very good book, called Here Comes Everybody. Clay Shirky is one of these guys who writes in sort of consultant speak and writes these bestseller books, but there's actually some content in them, which is always handy. And And his one of his big points is that it isn't the technology, that this is a social event, and that it has been brought about because the technology is now basically a decade old and is ubiquitous. Everyone's got access to it, and therefore new social formations start emerging. So Web 2 is a culture change, and these are five of the 8 themes that O'Reilly highlighted in his essay, What is Web 2.0, which followed his presentation the previous year in 2004. Now, if you look at those things, these things are not easy for companies, and they are, if you look at the next slide, all I've done is it's exactly the same slide, but I've just changed Web 2 to Government 2.0, and it sort of looks positively oxymoronic and scary and things, because governments just don't kind of, government agencies don't feel comfortable doing those things naturally. Even though, if you think about the sort of kind of philosophy of government, it would suggest that they should be doing all of these things. But somehow, in the professionalisation of delivering government, within the crucible of adversarial politics, which is an important part of it, and whatever the bureaucratisation of government, all these things kind of went out the window. And they're very difficult for governments to sort of flick the switch back towards these things. Now, I was wandering through the botanical gardens of Brisbane about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I came across this nice looking thing, and I read the plaque, and as one does these days with one's iPhone, I took pictures of both, because it struck me that this was a time, can you read this? You guys read that? I can make stuff up. Anyway, this just, it sort of says that this is in honour of the first guy who ran the botanical gardens, and this, it was a Queensland's first ornamental drinking fountain, and it used the first ornamental drinking fountain in Queensland, and was also the first functional use of reticulated water. So what was happening, and that's 1867, so what was happening in Queensland is that the public sector in the 19th century was building public goods. It understood itself as building public goods. It improvised around what kind of public goods needed to be built, and away it went and built these public goods. And government 2.0 is built around platforms that are public goods. Now, I actually mean that in a I mean that in a quite technical sense, in the economist sense of a public good, that it is non-rivalrous and it doesn't exclude. If I buy a car or buy a cookie, that's a car I've got and somebody else doesn't have, and so it's a rivalrous good. Information is not a rivalrous good. If I've got some information, somebody else can have the information and everybody's happy. And then there's the question of exclusion. The way economists have defined public goods is that public goods, in addition to having that quality of non-rivalrousness, they are non-excludable. And the classic example is defence. We can't defend Australia without defending everybody in it, except for the people who might want to fight on the other side, I guess. And it's true of a traffic light. A traffic light is a local public good. You can't sort of exclude people from taking advantage of that traffic light. And governments are typically associated in economic textbooks with building public goods, but they didn't build any of those public goods. So that's really a very big deal. That's a big change. And we're getting this explosion of public goods, which are platforms on which people can privately run around. I used the analogy of coral yesterday when I was launching the Victorian Public Sector Information Hub, and I ended up calling the people in the audience polyps, which they didn't mind too much. But after the event, someone suggested that they were the Polyp Bureau, which rather appeals to me. So anyway, this is something that's to be that I think is worth thinking about. Governments exist to build public goods. They didn't build any of those, and I think you would understand when I say to you that I don't think they should have built any of those. It's hard to believe that they would have done such a great job. In fact, you know, the equivalent is the White Pages, I suppose. And if you compare getting information out of the White Pages even now, sort of 10 years after effective privatisation and so on, Google's a lot more nimble than White Pages, Yellow Pages and all these sorts of things. So government exists to build public goods. The government didn't build any of these public goods. And then, as I used to say this, I still say it, you've seen me say it, I then thought to myself, actually, private companies didn't build any of those either. They were all built in garages. They were all startups, which is a remarkable thing. And so these characteristics that make up Web 2, collaborate, don't control, and so on, are sort of social values of business that have to kind of get reinvented. They didn't sort of pop up in any previously existing established company, despite the fact that Microsoft and Apple and so on were pumping lots and lots of money into trying to catch the next IT wave. None of them caught onto it. Okay, so that's all fairly scary for government. We're not suggesting that government, public servants and politicians become hippies. These are some of the ways in which large companies are already obviously trying to make use of Web 2. But governments are special because governments are the builders of public goods, and governments have this massive amount of this massive resource of platforms and information and so on that can be given a whole new world of value given these new possibilities. So, first message is to adapt the new tools because they can bring you lots of benefits. So Dell is a good example of that, but Dell has a site called IdeaStorm where it invites people in to publicly comment on their products with a view to getting really good discussions going about what consumers want in the next generation of products. And it has taken the message that it has to be fairly candid and it can't sort of moderate this site too heavily because it actually wants people in there enjoying themselves and putting in the time to helping them make better products. Explore the potential for openness to optimise the mission of various public agencies, and there are all sorts of fantastic things that can be done. I'll mention just a few of them. You're sitting on platforms of huge social value, as the Parliamentary Library understands. I don't know when the briefs went public on the net, but I think it was 96, and I think there was a bit of kind of, but they're ours type, there were a few people around who said, but they're ours, you know, why should we do that, they're for the parliamentarians and so on. And they're incredibly valuable. This is work that's been done and it, bang, goes on the net, becomes a public good in the technical sense. So then there is the issue of building new platforms and public goods. I was talking to Mark Scott of the ABC, who I went and saw during the course of the task force, and one of the things I said to him was, I sort of gave him this idea of public goods, and I said, now all of these people, all of these firms that are building these public goods of Web 2.0, if they can't turn it to money, they don't have any alternative source of funding. Now, in fact, there is a sort of philosophy of Web 2, which is that you build for social value, and if you're confident you can build social value, you figure that you're going to be able to make money out of it somehow in the future. And the classic, I mean, Google didn't advertise for a year when it got going, and Twitter still doesn't know quite how it's going to make money. But it's still churning away, doing all that stuff, and it's worth $1 billion right now without a plan to make money. So that's how it's done in the private sector. But think of how many really socially valuable platforms could be built that the private sector won't build because they genuinely see that they can't make money out of it. And that's one such platform that has subsequently been built. and that's been built by the ABC. All of the ABC's regional stations, which number something like 52, are getting a multimedia facilitator whose job it is to engage the local community and get the local community to essentially to make their own media. So they're going to help, you know, so please bring us stuff and we'll teach you how to produce a TV program or a radio program, or, you know, we might give you a recorder, although you don't really need to do that these days because people have got all this stuff, and or if they don't, it's amazingly cheap. I think that's a fantastically exciting thing. No other country has done anything like this on anything like that scale. And let's hope it works out well. We don't know yet. That's the thing about all this. We don't really know. So why does Web2 matter? One of the points that Clay Shirky makes is that Web2 allows organisation without organisations. Now, that of course always existed in the world. There were things we could do, like go on a picnic and you don't need to book anything with the picnic organisation authority. But there are... Clay Shirky's attitude, I think it's my attitude, is organisations are bad things, we just need them. What I mean by that is that organisations consume a lot of resources, a lot of angst in running themselves, and they have to do that, and they also do other things. We can't build cars without organisations. We can't organise picnics without organisations. It turns out that we can write an encyclopedia without a proprietary limited company worth billions of dollars orchestrating that process. It turns out that we can do that Web2 now creates a whole range of things that we can do without organisations, although I think the more powerful sort of metaphor is not doing without organisations. Most things in the public sector will remain, but we can open the organisations up and have them much more a partnership between the users and the producers, which is a sort of Dell computers model. So that there are all these remarkable possibilities. Web2 achieves what it does by lowering the cost of failure. Again, the first example there is from Clay Shirky, and meetup.com facilitates tens of thousands of meetings around the world, and it does it by lowering the cost of trying to organise a meetup to a minuscule amount of trouble. So hundreds of thousands of meetups are proposed and tens of thousands more meetups occur. So this is a site where you go on and you say, you know, nursing mothers interested in macrame meeting in Balmain Park on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. and you don't even have to turn up to know whether it's going to work out or not, because if people are interested in going, they'll reply and say, yeah, I'll see you there. So that's an example of the tendrils of intelligence getting out to so that all sorts of possibilities materialise, which couldn't have been realised in the past. Google is always listening. The way Google designs a website, if Google decides to redesign its website or a service, it doesn't do it by taking it down to a department in the agency or contracting it out and saying, give us a new design. What it will do is it will integrate the process of design. It might do all of those things, but it will integrate the process of design with what it's doing right now and the data that it's able to generate moment by moment. So if we wonder whether we should have a red line across this part of the screen and how it will affect the behaviour of people online, we put it up. 50% of people who see the screen with a red line and 50% of people see the screen without the red line, and Google works out how that affects their behaviour. An incredibly powerful use of all this information, so much of which we normally think it's quite sort of normal to throw away. And this is a contribution, this is an idea that is in some senses original to our report, I think, and I think it's incredibly important. One of the things about Web 2 is that, again, it's the sort of hippie, it's the hippie aspect of it. Web 2, Gov 2 is promoted as something which in a kind of a naive way improves democracy and makes everything more contestable and transparent. Now, all of that is true, but the upshot of that was that when Obama got into power and held a sort of America-wide town hall meeting and voting for favourite ideas on a website, a sort of, well, a kind of sort of a wiki, I suppose, I don't know, within a month or two of coming to office, he wanted to know what the most important things on American people's minds were, and that he got the answer that the most important thing Americans wanted was to see his birth certificate, and the another, and but I think that came second, because the thing that came first is that the most popular thing or the best thing to do would be to legalise marijuana. You can see the problem, that you can see that that doesn't, well, it doesn't actually make a big contribution. It's kind of nice to know, except that it's not really knowledge. It's mostly a mostly political activity there rather than knowledge that's being generated, but some knowledge is being generated. So if you want these things to work well, have a look at open source software, because open source software doesn't work by, you know, that's about as, that makes the most complex software human beings have ever built, all built by volunteers, and it doesn't do it by taking votes on what code goes where, or just saying anyone can contribute to the code. In fact, successful open source projects are very hierarchical, but they basically work by reputation. The people in the hierarchy figure out who is good, who can contribute, and then they start using them more if they're prepared to contribute more. This isn't a sort of a sort of scary totalitarian vision, because nobody owns the software, and somebody can say, you guys are mucking all this up and I'm going to fork Linux or Firefox over here and start again. So that's the great protection that we get. So I think that there's a sort of quite a lot of naive democratic flummery about government 2.0, but let's have a look at, but that is opposed to the use of 2.0 to get somewhere where you really get the information you need when you want it. Anyone who hasn't seen me talk about this stuff, and I haven't seen too many people here who have, know who a person called Tanter is? Well, Tanter was quoted in US federal government research, by the US Fed. She was an English academic and until about 7 or 8 years ago. She gave up her job and went to work in the mortgage industry in Virginia, I think. And she did that for 5 years, and then she fell ill and she was at home. She decided to blog, and she started blogging on an existing financial website called Calculated Risk, I think. And she wrote these long, meticulously detailed and hilarious descriptions of life in the mortgage industry. This is circa 2007, getting through 2008. You're kind of getting the picture. People start getting very interested in all this stuff. And she starts getting linked to by people like Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner. And so in the space of a few months, the person who can tell us the most about what we need to know turns up on the internet. We don't know who she is. She calls herself Tanta, but we know that the things she says checks out. She has no motive to be misleading us, and she becomes an important source. And she's linked, as I say, she's discovered not by Paul Krugman, but by, you know, this hierarchy of reputation. She's discovered by someone who Paul Krugman occasionally goes and reads on his blog. And then she becomes part of the conversation. And then she gets quoted by the US Federal Reserve. Well, Tanta is Doris Dunney, and she was at home with ovarian cancer, and she died. She died at the end of 2008. And there was a sort of a bit of a... Well, this bloke, Steve Randy Waldman, wrote a really nice blog post about the fact that at the end of 2008, Paul Krugman, who was a blogger, won the Nobel Prize in Tanta, who had made this great contribution, had died, and for him it was a sort of... they were two bookends. But the point is that if you think about... I mean, none of this could have happened 20 years ago. If Tanta wanted to be taken seriously, she would have had to have had the appropriate letters after a name, then spent, or if not, been in the industry and worked her way up the industry, and so on. Probably 10 or 15 years, and we can see there that she wasn't going to do that, and yet she gave us what she had right there and then. Steve Randy Waldman is a really interesting guy who I've emailed a few times and who writes fantastically interesting economic posts, who Paul Krugman and other people, he's one of these top bloggers who, you know, everyone links to. And they have titles like "What is a Financial System?" He's really trying to kind of think about this stuff from really... first principles, at the same time as comes up with all sorts of really fascinating ideas about how we could reform finance. Who's Steve Randy Waldman? He's a PhD student at Kentucky University. And he's taken seriously because he has something to say. So this is a new kind of world in which status authority is given not by jumping through hoops that are kind of controlled by anyone at the top. They're influenced by people at the top, but it's top of a different world. It's not the top of an organisation. It's a sort of open reputational system, like science, if you like. So one needs stable identity, but one doesn't need one's passport. You don't need to know anything other than some expression like Tanta, which, by the way, was Doris Dungy's family nickname. You then make a contribution. People assess that contribution, and on the basis of that, you acquire a reputation, and that gives you the authority. And this is highly fluid and highly contingent on a high level of contribution. This is a nice little curve which shows you how you kind of get tempted into this world, as I did. You know, you see a blog and then you link it as a favourite. Well, I barely use favourites anymore. I don't tag, which is terrible. Lots of people don't tag. So bane of Web 2.0, because Web 2.0 would be much better with more tags, but tagging is boring and nobody does it. Maybe that's something governments could do. Because they can pay, that's my point. And, you know, you comment, and I never subscribe to anything much, and then you might email stuff around, and then you start writing, and then you then find yourself leading this blog if you're up to it, if other people think you're up to it. And the thing is, nobody comes and tells you, look, you're hopeless. No, it's just nobody comes and reads you. So it's a really kind of very, very nice and painless way of doing things. So Web2 makes these incredible connections. Incentive is a company. Anyone know of Incentive? Incentive is a company in the United States on which large companies, Procter & Gamble, post, and other companies, post technical challenges. Like, and this is a real one, how to get toothpaste out of toothpaste tubes more easily, get more toothpaste out of the tube. And some physicists, and then there are solvers at the other side, and they offer a prize, $20,000, for improving the parameter of squeezing this toothpaste out of the tube by more than 10%. And Incentive is a thriving business, which uses Web2 to bring together problems and solvers. This is the Netflix prize that was awarded very recently. Anyone know what that is? $1 million offered by Netflix to for anyone, put out a huge amount of their own data, all anonymised, of course, and they do video rentals. And they had an algorithm which would look at what you had, what you'd hired and what you thought of it, and would make recommendations based on what everybody else. So doing what Google does with links, with movies. And they worked out that because they had a much lower retail footprint than Blockbuster and all these other places, so their competitive advantage is in this stuff. So they worked out it's going to be worth a lot more than $1 million to them to get their algorithm at least 10% more efficient. And so they offered $1 million for it. And it took a long time to solve. The first really big breakthrough only offered 3.99% improvement, but that was a new statistical technique applied to this, some kind of statistical profiling. Meanwhile, these two guys are sitting in a kitchen and they're really keen on all this stuff, but they don't know any statistics. And a community developed around the site, and people were sort of sharing bits and pieces of what they were doing. And in fact, this group of people represents something like 5 independent groups that came together, and they finally got it to 10%, and they picked up their $1 million prize. And I was talking to the founder of Kaggle the other day, who's a former Australian Treasury official and RBA analyst, and he, on his own, has set up this site. It's a monopoly, global monopoly. It's not making any money yet, but I'd buy shares in it if I could. And it will host data competitions. And part of what he will do, so he's going to provide us a hub and a whole lot of facilities for hosting data competitions. But one of the things he wants to do is he wants to create a world in which the Martin Biots and the Martin Chabers, though they are French-Canadians, in case you're interested, where they can sort of come through the pack, because he says one of the big problems is that people who are really have really powerful skills in a particular area don't find their way up hierarchies and social structures adequately to be regarded as the best person for the job. And so these people are just going to come from everywhere, and he's going to rank them. He's going to be providing much better information about their capabilities than seems to be available in the existing systems. An incredibly powerful thing, which will generate a far more social value for Anthony Goldblum, who's the guy who's doing this. It will generate far more social value than it will generate value for Anthony, but it'll generate enough for Anthony, for him to do very well out of it. What's in it for government from Web 2.0? An example, very simple, prosaic example, I think, is the National Library's newspaper digitisation project. How many people know about that? Quite a few. So National Library is digitising its newspapers back to 1803, and the way they do that is they take pictures of the pages and then they get computers to scan them. And what happens? Well, these are old, greying, yellowing, moth-eaten, rat-munched, flea-bitten newspapers, and the computers, no matter how much they work on them, make quite a few mistakes. And then when you're reading, and the value of digitising them is essentially to search them. And so they've got a hell of a lot of this stuff up now in the raw form. They may have it all up, I'm not sure, I don't think so. But they've got a lot of this stuff up. And then if you're reading the digitised words and they irritate you because they're wrong, you can just click through and correct the error. And this has really taken off in an extraordinary way. They didn't even launch it, but since it was made live, it has run 24/7 since its launch in 2007. I actually don't believe that. I think probably maybe the first night or something it might have been. But now there is no time. I can tell you right now that it's active. There will be 1 to 50 people on it correcting things. 23% of correctors are overseas. And I don't think they know yet how many of those are expats or whatever, but there are plenty of people overseas who take some kind of interest for whatever reason in our stuff. And it's really pretty fascinating reading newspapers from 1803. And I've corrected a few lines because they were irritating because they were wrong. Over 7 million lines of text were corrected. Julie Hempen style, that's Julie there. She's corrected over 300,000 of those lines. She prefers that doing that to housework. And yet her house seems to be in reasonable shape. I mention these things. It's important, again, my little anti-hippie angle here. I think Julie is a ferocious and possibly pathological competitor. And it seems to be the case that the people at the top of these pyramids who real power uses, it kind of takes over their life. And they're really very competitive with each other. So it may not be pretty. Sorry, yes.
What if Julie doesn't deal less poor English?
But then people will correct her.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's likely that Adil or someone with poor English is going to do a lot better than nobody. But, what do you think? I mean, you've just got to... over here, you see, you can have poor English, but you can read that it's Governor Philip. If it was in Italian, I would be better than useless at doing this, even though I don't know Italian. You get me? You just... it's a very kind of mechanical process, but it is it's something that human beings are better at than computers. Are you comfortable with that? Doesn't look like it.
Oh, not for this. I'm not, no. Because people are going on thinking they're reading the actual text from 1803 when, in fact, it could be read anything.
No, because right next to it is the text. Right next to it is the picture.
Oh, I see.
So.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right next
so
to it.
Side by side.
Side by side.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
side
no,
by
no,
side.
Yeah, okay.
And that's why they can correct it.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Oh, no, fair enough.
And by the way, I mentioned to say, if people want to jump in at any stage, you're more than
welcome. I can't see that.
Yeah. The other thing is that one of the secrets of Web 2 is that vandalism is a sort of a low payoff activity. There's plenty of it around, but all you do is you just reset it. It's usually, unless you put a lot of time in, and vandals don't tend to want to put a lot of time into their vandalism, you just reset it. It's all gone. But in fact, they've had no vandalism whatsoever. And that's very often the case. But it, if you've got the Prime Minister's blog or something like that, you will get all sorts of carrying on. It depends very much where you are, what sort of thing you're doing.
But this is the room that we're in.
You're aware of the fact that there will be some things that you're in. If you want to write something about electricians in roofs right now, you might find that you're in that world. But don't overdo it. I mean, I find this often, that public servants are going to say, oh, we can't do that because it's incredibly controversial. And yet if you look at what they do, 98% of what they're doing is well outside the bounds of that, and huge amounts of value can be added by a more open approach. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be helpful for you to be talking right now about electricians in roofs. So it's a sort of a judgment thing. But I think when we can move the bounds where public servants get engaged a long way, a lot further than we do at the moment. But I'll get on to that anyway. So this is another thing that happened to me when we did the task force. I would go and I would see people and I would talk to them about this stuff, and I would talk to them about some stuff that I haven't yet shown you, and they would say, oh damn, we've just redesigned our website. And they'd redesigned their website doing the usual sort of thing that you do, but they hadn't sort of invited the community in. They hadn't invited people to sort of show them, ideas that they had. And it really is incredible how productive this can be. And I'll show you some examples of this. Before I do, let me just make some of those points. Good heavens, I'm getting riding along the top there. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Vandalism.
Well, there you go. That's interesting. I wonder how that happened. It didn't happen yesterday. Okay, yes. Well, that's what you get for saying things about Julie Hempen style. I will move on from that. The point being made there was that that information is a potential public good, and once you let it out on the internet, it is a public good, unexcludable and non-rivalrous. And the other thing about information is that it is intensely serendipitous. You'll hear a lot of talk in government about how you've got to get your, you know, you've got to work out what your purposes are for releasing this data and stuff like that. Fine thing to do, just remember that people will make use of your data in ways that you would never have imagined. And it's very important, therefore, that you not constrain information going out, which could have a value that you don't get, that you don't understand in advance, and couldn't possibly even be persuaded in advance. So this is a nice little sort of triplet that someone on our international reference group, just a bunch of people that I emailed and said, Would you like to go on our international reference group? Please put our blog on your feed reader. Read it once a week and make a comment about once a month. We got 18 of the best people in the world on Web 2 just kind of taking a kindly interest in our activities by doing this. And this is David Isles's Eve's triplet of what matters about information. And that was our little triplet. Well, that was what we did in response, which was to hold mashup competitions and stuff like that, and to try to show people what might be possible. Sorry, we weren't showing them. We were sort of inviting other people in to show. And so we designed a very low-key event, gave it a very low-key name that wouldn't scare anybody, and held a competition and liberated 15 data sets, got them all licensed Creative Commons, which is very important. We can talk about that later. And some terrific things got done. I used to show a lot of those in my presentation. I'm only going to show you one from the GovHack, but I'll show you a mashup that changed the world. This was a mashup that was actually done a while ago. This is on Google Maps. This is the outbreak of a disease in London, and you might gather that these two little red dots come into the story at some stage. In fact, the mashup was by John Snow, was in the middle of the 19th century. It blew away the miasma theory of disease. If the miasma theory was true, then the outbreak should have been down near the Thames. The water outlet nearer the Thames was not contaminated. That water outlet was contaminated. Bang, the germ theory of disease was born. So we didn't manage to come up with any mashups that changed the world, but it is amazing how valuable these things are and can be. This was a site that someone built in 24 hours. It is based on a UK site called Fix My Street, somewhat more prosaically. And it's a terrific idea, which is that a somewhat irreverent site enables people to come onto it and say what things are buggered. That information, the sort of trick here is that information is then fed to governments. Governments are then publicly tracked as to how quickly they fix things. After you go on and say what's buggered, then it says things like, how exactly is it buggered? And your email address to track the unbuggering. So you go onto a Google map and you just grab these different, signals to say that, you know, near the red one, there was an accident, and now to the right of this one here, something else needs to be done, and so on. So it's a powerful and very simple way to communicate with government, and the hook is that government's performance gets tracked. Here, this is magpie swooping, and you may think that's funny. I thought it was funny, and I went ha ha and mentioned it to a cyclist who didn't think it was funny at all, and pointed out to me that this is a sort of major safety issue. And that's my point, that you can't know in advance what might be valuable. I might say this isn't public sector information about where magpies were swooping, no one's collecting that. That is crowdsourced information. People go onto it and just add to it, and I'm sure they've added a lot more since I took that picture. So that's our report. The logo was crowdsourced. I think it's a fantastic logo. We got ourselves a nice little controversy about whether we were exploiting designers in the process, and I was sort of felt I felt that we'd mucked things up when that was happening, and now I think it was actually a kind of nice illustration that, you know, you ruffle some feathers, it wasn't too much of a disaster. And the fact was lots of members of the task force were volunteers themselves. And this guy's name, I should tell you, is Ben Crothers of Catch Media, and that is his remuneration. Okay, so, which isn't bad around the country. I talk about that logo quite a bit. Our central finding is, as you can see in front of you, and I won't read it out, our central recommendation is that we need a declaration of open government at the highest levels of government to say this stuff is really important, we want to encourage people to do it, and that actually gives them some kind of permission, and then we can sort of wrestle our way through the dilemmas and the problems that will come up, because it raises important difficulties that we don't have any perfect ways through this, just as we didn't have any perfect ways through the dilemmas of opening up a bunch of other things. Other recommendations were to establish a lead agency to coach, enable, advocate and coordinate effort. Use the information commissioner to deliver accountability to the open government policy. Government is full of policies that are adopted in principle and then are traduced on a daily basis in practice. One example of that is policies for less regulation, which all governments talk about, but not in this particular case. If we are genuinely to deliver the policy of opening, and I'm thinking particularly of opening up public sector information, we need a process whereby some independent officer who is responsible for interpreting and enforcing, to some extent, or at least commenting in a transparent and public way, is able to say whether this is consistent with the policy in individual circumstances, even if the minister isn't very comfortable with it. Encourage agencies to engage and innovate online. Encourage public servants to engage online. New APSC guidelines, they're certainly the envy of the states, and I suspect the envy of quite a few public servants in the world. The point about this is that there's nothing kind of, in terms of policy, there is nothing different between these guidelines and the previous guidelines, except that they start by saying this is really a worthwhile thing to be doing, and that's all the fine print, and that's what you would expect. I mean, it might be nice if it was a bit shorter, but nobody's suggesting that this stuff happen outside the basic structures of the Public Service Code of Conduct and the Public Service Act and so on. Here's somebody who is now making the transition from this stuff having been a millstone around his neck. It's Craig Tomler, who writes all this stuff in his spare time. This blog is now widely consulted around Australia and elsewhere on IT Web 2 matters. It's produced privately by Craig, who is a public servant. He's been through the difficulties of senior people who are in positions in higher positions than him, making life difficult for him. He's now in a situation where they're kind of quite comfortable with this. But it's actually now starting to turn to his advantage in the sense that people can tell, just like Tanta was damn good at what she did, people can tell that Craig is a contributor. There's lots of people saying, I want Craig in my team. So this is actually, it's actually important for this to work out for the champions, because we can't sort of do this over the dead bodies of martyrs or we won't get anywhere. It reminds me actually of the rise of science, where science was transformed from a closed, secretive military endeavour in the 16th century into an open one in the 17th century. Essentially, the superstar scientists of Europe needed to advertise. They needed to advertise to get the great princes of Europe to be their patrons, and the great princes of Europe needed to open the science up because they needed to try and make sure they weren't getting some quack, and they had no idea whether they were getting some quack. They didn't have the expertise to work out. So I think this is starting to happen, and it's starting to people are starting to see some really it provides a way for people who are really good to actually show how good they are. Now, one senior public servant said to me, I don't want the, you know, most of my senior staff feeling that they need to blog. And I said to her, no, they'd certainly, nobody needs to blog. But the other thing is that a lot of people will find when they blog that nobody really wants to read what they write. So that's fine. This is a world, you know, blogging is a world in which some people can make a contribution and other people can have their blogs and they will make their own kind of minor contributions in a whole bunch of ways. But there isn't a kind of, I don't think there's this big risk that everybody feels the need to be an Uber blogger, because if they do, we're going to be disappointed. They're not going to be. With public sector information, so we argued that all the default for public sector information, all of the information that is produced within government, essentially, the default is that it's open. The default is that it's to be released in a machine-readable and transformable fashion, so it can be used in mashups. That it is free, as in beer, and free, as in speech, to use the terms that Richard Stallman used about open-source software, because open-source software, as far as Richard Stallman's concerned, he's the kind of founder and guru of open-source software. It isn't necessarily gratis. It isn't necessarily free as in beer. You can sell open source software. The important thing about openness of software from his point of view is that it is licensed. The IP licenses enable people to transform it, play with it, and so on. That means, so this free as in speech means some kind of Creative Commons licensing in the Australian context, unless there is a reason to keep it confidential, and there are lots of reasons that governments will need to keep stuff confidential, but often they can still release it, but in appropriately anonymised and treated form. And to accelerate take-up, we proposed that there be a data.gov.au arrangement. The advantage of that is it's a central hub where people can go, and it's also a hub of expertise, because if the Department of the Environment or a particular, you know, Murray Valley Authority or whoever else wants to release data, they may not have the expertise to do it, and so the idea is that that is all there as a sort of a one-stop shop within the government. And so that will make public sector information an increasingly valuable social good. I will just tell you that I showed this. The point about those, this is where I concluded a presentation in New South Wales two or three months ago. It was late last year. New South Wales had gone from being one of the least advanced states as far as this agenda is concerned to being one of the most advanced states as far as the agenda is concerned, simply by announcing an apps competition, simply by announcing being the first state to announce a mashup competition. Then everybody was running around trying to find data and trying to release it and so on. And so I wanted to make the point to the Minister for Planning at the time that firstly, if she really wanted to get going, that she could really, it was amazing how much you could achieve quickly by just getting things happening and then people get the hang of it. And I also wanted to suggest to her that she didn't really have much of an option. I showed her SideWiki. That was her website. And if you're, Google had just released a product called SideWiki. And what SideWiki is that if you're looking at that and you're wondering if anybody has made some comments on it, you just repair away to SideWiki, which is on the side, and you can make comments and read other people's comments. And as I wrote there, the Planning Minister, I'd like everyone to know that the Planning Minister is listening carefully, which she was, and she listens.
That's a Google product.
That's a Google product.
Working side by side, the actual website.
That's right. It's
quite independent.
That's right. And it tells your browser. This is coming from the Department of Planning server. This is coming from Google server. And it simply tells the browser to have a split screen. So it's not on the planning server, but you may as well be.
So every website has effectively become
APH.gov.au/library. That's what can happen. And she did listen carefully. She listened so carefully that now she's the Premier of New South Wales. So that's nice to know. That. Sorry, what was that?
The poison chalice.
Yeah. So I told you I would tell you about these things in conclusion, and so I will. Anyone know who they are?
Charles
I. No, it's not. It's a relative. And actually, I don't think he's a relative. She's a relative. And those are the only king and queen of England who were actually joint monarchs. They weren't a consort, you know, a monarch and a consort of a monarch. You know who they are? William and Mary. And as you may know, James the Second had a bit of a shot at absolute monarchy, as the French monarchs were going for absolute monarchy, and it didn't work out. And back in Holland, his sister had married William of Orange, and they had a constitutional monarchy, and so they came across and ran the first constitutional monarchy in England. And this amazing expression arose, which is we would be familiar with today, actually. But it's an odd expression. It sounds like saying something rude, but it was actually a compliment. And the expression was a free nation deep in debt. And the point was that Holland for some time, and now England, was able to borrow to fund, the king was able to borrow to fund civil activities, or more likely for at least a couple of hundred years, wars. And people who lent him the money expected to get it back. That was a big new thing. So this is a nice illustration of how less control becomes more power. And it was one of the kind of, you'll find that in Pericles' funeral oration in Athens. This is if you can do it right, this is an incredibly, this is a fabulous thing to do. It makes you richer, it makes you happier, freer, and so on. Keep in mind, you can also screw it up, because her relatives got their head chopped off 30 years, 40 years before. Thereupon arose 20 years of misery and chaos. So it's often hard to do, but if the things are kind of in place, you can go right off the controls and things kind of set themselves up. Adam Smith made exactly the same point about commerce. If you want commerce to do well, then generally speaking, just let commerce do what commerce does. We don't have to decide whether we go into cars or wheat or whatever. And Hayek, who regarded himself as a philosopher and economist in the tradition of Smith, Smith, by the way, was a lefty in his time and a big favourite of the French revolutionaries, and I don't think Hayek liked that about him. But he did like the sort of free market stuff. And one of the things that is implicit in Adam Smith is the idea that information is incredibly important, and that people out there in the marketplace have the information and governments don't have the information. This was the basis on which Hayek predicted that the Soviet Union was not viable and would collapse, and it did. And quite obviously, in a sort of mega comparison between central planning and capitalism, it's pretty obvious who's won that. But that doesn't answer a major question, which Hayek showed sadly no interest in at all, which is that central planning is inevitable. With all the Web 2 in the world, we will need large centrally planned companies, large centrally planned agencies in government. So what insights from him and him and him might be brought to central planning? Well, I think Toyota started showing the way when it started developing management systems which treated people on the assembly line as knowledge workers, but even actually went beyond that and started saying, what can our customers tell us? What can our suppliers tell us? And started thinking of the whole organisation as a sort of organic unity or an organic entity, which was really about managing information and not just sort of imagining that people at the centre with the highest university degrees could work out what to do. And now Google comes along, and Google sees itself as a kind of carapace or a place in which there is a somewhat chaotic market-like activity based on enthusiasm. One day in every week in Google, you can work on what you want to work on for Google. You don't get to work on what you want to work on because you think it would be cool for you. You are assessed on that work, but you decide what it is. And what does that do? It sends signals to the employees about their value and about this is how we want you to be an employee. Equally, I think equally important, possibly more important, I don't have any reading to base this on, but I think it might be the case. I think one of the crucial things about this is that it enables organic connections to be made between people with similar enthusiasms, whatever team they've been put in by their superiors. And so you get these pockets of enthusiasm that can operate to produce things that the company on its own, thinking of the company as the sort of top strata of management, would never have thought of. And that, and the, some of the things that this process has produced has been Gmail and AdSense. AdSense must be responsible for 20 or 30% of Google's revenue, but don't quote because I haven't checked it. That's the vista that we confront. I'm sorry I've gone on for a bit longer, but you all seem to be quite intrigued, so I've kept going. And I've run out of things to say, and happy to respond to any questions.
That was fantastic business. Thanks.
Thank you.
Enjoyable and interesting. But still, the idea of putting all this onto government or involving government in this, which just seems like a very poor fit. I mean, 99% of all of this is absolute garbage, and we don't get to. We all choose not to have anything to do with it. Government is supposed to be apart from all that stuff. So that's sort of a general, I mean, I find it hard to put it more precisely than that. There are parameters that government should operate under. And also, more specifically, the idea of public servants blogging, that sounds quite, you know, hard to imagine because public servants have to get everything approved in triplicate and
It would have to, that sort of thing would have to change. So let me try and make it sound less radical. I'm not suggesting any big changes to the way we do things. I'm suggesting some small but radical changes to the way we do things, by which I mean, well, we've got Craig blogging away, okay? He's not paid for his blogging, but it would be set, given that, you know, departments spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year producing newsletters and he produces a better newsletter than most newsletters, it would be make sense to say, look, you seem to have worked out a way to do this which respects the public service principles, and it's very valuable, and so there is a kind of an active model. I guess what I'm trying to say in most of this stuff is, if you find this stuff confronting, and you think it's kind of crazy and it won't work, then try and think of this crazy thing that won't work, and try and think about some quite small thing that is essentially the same thing, but it's sufficiently uncontroversial or technical or whatever where it would work, and just start there. So let's say you're an econometrician. Andrew Lee is one of Australia's best econometricians, did a stint at Treasury and was told by a senior manager who will remain nameless that he wasn't allowed to run his blog. Now, I think that is ridiculous. One of the main things he does on the blog is to say, look at this stuff that the National Bureau of Economic Research has produced in America. It's really interesting. He might put up a post saying, I've done this econometric technique on this particular set of data, but I still haven't, you know, sort of a Netflix thing. I still haven't worked out how to use this part of the data. Can anyone help me? He knows that he shouldn't be putting a blog up saying, look, frankly, I agree with Wayne Swan and I disagree with Tony Abbott. And think about the fact that public servants are out there commenting in principle, in public, all the time when they answer questions at conferences. So in some kind of basic sense, this is already happening, and we're just talking about a slightly different medium. I think that if we sort of just start trying to crawl up that ladder, we can get a fair way before we get to that sort of fiery furnace of you know, high levels of controversy, in which case public servants shouldn't be jumping into that. But we lose so much from not being able to simply talk openly. So on the board of Sustainability Victoria, I don't think I may be committing a crime by saying this, but I'm certainly not doing anything wrong. We discussed at the last board meeting performance assessment of what we were doing, and we were going to get consultants in, and everyone was, you know, poncing about on the board. None of us knew all that much about it. And I said, this is a perfect thing to blog about. We should be saying, look, we're reviewing our performance measurement, and we could be conducting a public conversation about what we were doing. It's not very controversial. It's what we should be doing. You know, and we're not doing it. But if we did do it, someone would say, look, you know, that waste program that you're running, well, they do something very similar in Saskatchewan, but they do it better in this particular way. All sorts of connections would be made. We would find people that we'd want to ring up and ask questions about. So, and none of that, so that's a huge amount of benefit, in my opinion. And what's the risk? Pretty nothing, it seems to me. And if you're worried about the controversy, stay away from it. You can still publicly say, you know, I'm in the parliamentary library, I'm working on something on referendums or something. And you would make that announcement, preferably at a time, you won't say I'm working on installation of insulation. You know, if you don't want, if you think that's not a good idea. Sorry. Yeah.
Dr. Rome, in terms of the baby steps sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of your talk is directed at intranet. Are there many examples of departments that are using intranet for this sort of stuff?
I yesterday launched the VPS Hub, which creates complete Web 2 functionality for all public servants in. I think there are 13,000 public servants in Victoria, so they can friend people, they've got profiles, they can write wikis and internal blogs and so on. You can invite others into your particular spaces with whatever permissions you want to give them. And I was involved in sort of helping design that. Now, I don't know, it may not be hugely successful. It's certainly a try. A guy called Shubha Banerjee in the Prime Minister's Department showed me some terrific stuff that he's working on, which is just internal to PM&C, where they're sort of trying to run ideas, workshops and things on their intranet. There are people trying to bring it about. I mean, one of the things I pointed out at the launch yesterday was that if we were Google, and we're not because we don't have that level of sophistication yet, but if we were Google, we'd be listening into all these conversations and then sending emails to people saying, there's a similar pattern of expertise and problems that you're working on over an environment with this person over in health. Would you like, you know, we're not going to tell you who they are, but if you consent to having your name and contact sent to that person, we'll send them to you. You know, all these kinds of things. And you could, you know, these things sort of grow and grow in your imagination. You could ultimately hook those kinds of introductions up to public servants in other jurisdictions, and on it goes. So those are, and you know, that's not, I'm not suggesting anyone should be in a hurry to do those things. What I'm saying is that this is a new world that is really new, and we just need to kind of try and build our capability and our familiarity with it. Because as you would know from your own work on your own computer, most of this stuff you teach yourself. Your training courses can be useful, but most of it is doing it. Yes.
I'm just going to take one more question, and then Dr. Rill did indicate he'd be happy.
I'm happy to hang around, but you guys may want an official running away time.
Okay.
Yeah. We've talked about the sort of the public benefits of doing this, and I suppose in the same way the public benefits of free markets are sort of everybody's well-being is a lot higher, the sort of private benefits to existing monopolies or cartels or guilds are sort of set up strong incentives to resist that.
Yep.
And in the private sector, we've sort of heard a lot of concerns about the risks involved with doing this.
Who in the private sector?
In the public sector.
In the public sector, there's lots of risks. There are perceived risks.
Perceived risks, and people are very responsive to those. But they're private risks to the public servant in terms of it makes life a lot more difficult for me if this...
Yeah, career-limiting moves are always possible and more easy.
But what I'm creating here is a public good. What's the link in order to allow the public servant or the manager or whatever to capture or somehow receive some of the upside as well in delivering this?
Well, yeah.
Is there a different management model that's needed or...
Well, it's a very good question. It's far too good for me to give you a good answer. What motivates public servants? I mean, my personal view is that the public service is in a kind of a terrible state in some ways because it's not aligned with what motivates public servants, which is mostly, the good ones are kind of intrinsically motivated, mostly and publicly motivated. And so I kind of think, unless you can measure output and productivity well, things like bonuses are not only kind of hokey, but they're likely to be quite counterproductive in lots of ways. What you can appeal to, I think, to take that a little further, that if you compare the public service with academia, academia is no great shakes either in lots of ways, and I'm actually thinking about an academia about 30 or 40 years ago, but because academia has become much more managerialist as well. But I just remember a thought that was given to me by someone who worked in Treasury at sort of level six, if such a level still exists, in a sort of 30 or 40 years ago, and he was a pretty academic type. And he said, you know, it's odd that the head of a department is a kind of a position to which you aspire and you kind of hang on to it until you retire, when in a university department, the last thing you want to be is the head of the department. At least in that sense, I think that we could sort of appeal to those things a lot more in the public sector, rather than bonuses and stuff like that. I would like to see, if you're a really good public servant, then you might get a six-month, and you want this, you might get a six-month sabbatical during which time it is expected that you write something, not of sort of Nobel Prize-winning stature, but of a serious contribution to thinking about policy and so on. Now, in that kind of world, this sort of stuff becomes its own reward to a substantial extent. The other thing I would say is that, as I've said at a few other functions, the cultural sector are my babies because they are proving this stuff up. They've got much lower risks, but I also want to... It's not just that they've got lower risks. People who work for, the National Gallery or the National Library, some of them are just the usual time servers, but a lot of them are motivated, are sort of publicly motivated, and they see their institution in a fairly simple way as an institution for opening things up to the public. If we can get some more of that, then these things can become their own reward. But so what I've said is kind of old-fashioned in a way, that we don't have much more to appeal to in the public sector other than intrinsic motivation, because extrinsic motivation... Oh, the other one is fame. And that's the kind of... that's the trashy end of reputation and respect, and that respect has been, it's in Adam Smith, the respect of others, the respect of one's profession has been a major motivator of very high quality work from time immemorial. Most of the greatest work that is done for the respect of others and for intrinsic motivation. Look at sport, look at science, these are where the greatest, the kind of most verifiably great human achievements are, and they're not done for bonuses. So there's plenty to appeal to, but somehow I think we're not appealing to it. We're appealing to this kind of top-down world of strategic this and report, accountability here and there. Now, you need a lot of those things. I'm not saying throw those out the window, but somehow we are not harnessing intrinsic motivation. There is a footnote in our report which references an article in which public servants were surveyed about, asked questions from which was deduced their level of idealism. And the graph, time is here, public service, and their level of idealism is here. And the private sector sort of starts here and sort of goes like that. And the public sector starts here and goes like that. And I think that that's, I think you'd want to try and fix that up if you're really trying to make some progress here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gruen. I'm sure we'd all like to thank you this morning. We're going to be bookended by another series of bells any minute, so 2 o'clock, we'll get them again. So
We'll just buy another $7 billion worth of helicopters.
Thank you so much.
And you walk, if you want to talk about it more, you're welcome to.
Just going to put a piece to the people.